All right, why don't we begin? Oh, come on. Why don't I get to do the fun stuff? Oh, foo. I was going to do this. That's fine. Great. I'm trying to do my nice little sound effect and the mic doesn't work. It's all right. Oh, great. So I have no idea if this computer is going to blow up because it's now out of support. So, joy of XP. It is the 28th. Per a number of people's requests, given that we have a final oddly scheduled session for Thursday night, I am more than happy to do that one online. So hopefully you all could attend live. It will be at the same time, but it means you don't have to come here. And it will be recorded for those that can't. I know that your schedules may not expect you to be here on Thursday night. So am I misremembering people? Somebody said, people did ask last time about doing that online. But Thursday night, okay, same time, just... Okay, good. All right. Thank you for those of you who were able to get your client letters in, given the technical issues. I know that at least one set of videos was apparently duplicated, so I will try very hard to get that one up. And I will note that one of you, and I won't say who, but said person, I suspect knows who said person is, instead of writing to said person's own client, wrote to opposing counsel, which was not the assignment. And if said person hasn't figured this out, I will approach said person to let said person know that this memo really should have been to one's own client and not to Paul Rebell. But that's okay. So if said person can please redo that, probably a lot easier. Okay. The care and feeding, and that's what's going to be on the exam. No, just kidding. What I did say was we're going to do Thursday's class online because since it's an extra scheduled day, people may not necessarily be able to come in.
Okay.
So that's the story. The care and feeding of clients. It was interesting to me. The different tone that you took, all of you, in your letters. I think none was inappropriate. But it said a lot about how you saw that interrelationship. And so what I want to do, really, is... take some time to hear from those of you who are willing to share, who were able to complete the assignment, etc. What was your thinking? What was your choice in setting aside the substance? Because the substance was based on the discussion, but the tone, what you said, how you said it. Did you spend any time thinking? Because you all... took your own tack, and I would love to hear what your thought process was, if any, other than it's a letter, in how you did this.
Well, after watching the negotiation, I realized we really didn't get very far. Like, we talked a lot about substantive provisions in the agreement, but we didn't reach an agreement with any of them. With the exception of maybe one or two things. The tone that I took was that there are certain things, especially for a new startup company, I didn't want to make it a complete excuse, but for a new startup company in this industry to be so stubborn in an agreement or a negotiation, I thought it was not a good tact for them. so I try to use that and try and give a reason why we don't have an agreement or get into the second meeting.
I was wondering about that, because I will say that of the letters, yours was the most, and I don't mean this in the wrong way, opinionated. Do you mind if I share it? So I was wondering what was your thinking? So what I'm hearing is that was essentially a defensive move?
Well, I figured we were going to have to come back to the president of the corporation or someone high up in the corporation why we didn't get this agreement done. So, I mean, yeah, we're the legal department, but we're going to have to answer to somebody. Somebody's paying our bill. So I didn't want it to fall, the blame to fall on us, because I tried to, you'll see.
So what do we have here? This is yours, right?
Yeah.
After sitting down with a hipster attorney, I noticed several alarming signs. They're talking about one of the customs as a video game company is to grant a warranty concerning the ownership of intellectual property, or at a minimum, ownership of the proper intellectual property licenses. Hipster was not willing to give such a warranty at this time. I do not envision them achieving the level of success it has said it is capable of without fulfilling such a basic industry custom. This is also disturbing, the letter goes on, because the contract Hipster sent us obligated our company to place different IP notices on our products. More importantly, mandated us to cooperate in the enforcement of all rights in the Hipster software against infringers, potential infringers. As a subsidiary, it is possible that the parent company, Fogey Corp., owns it. However, their attorney would not even provide us with that information. I'm disappointed with the level of stubbornness and uncooperativeness that Hipster exhibited. In the best interest of our company, our department has set up a second meeting with them. It is my recommendation that if we cannot obtain a warranty or indemnification, we remove ourselves from a potentially damaging situation. Okay.
I had to interpret it somewhere.
You did have to interpret it.
I mean, how can we, if we're not going to get a warranty or a disclaimer or some kind of indemnification, then why would we go forward and expose ourselves to liability?
Well, that is certainly one possible approach, although whether or not one can say that a software publisher will always give you that warranty is an open question. I'm not sure I agree with that. I understand this is simulations, etc.
But I mean, I was just focusing on the warranty. But I mean, there were other, we really didn't get anywhere with a lot of the, he was not willing to negotiate. Provisions.
Fair enough.
So it's tough to come back with why was this not done.
Now, that is certainly one approach. Let me come back to it, because I want to share some, again, my views, but this is good. I think that you chose a tone for a specific reason and you carried through with it. Anybody else have a different approach and willing to share why?
For ours, I kind of talked more about and laid out kind of this is what went on, and there's maybe a little more research that you need to do. I know one thing for us was the profit sharing, so we needed to see if we were going to be able to, if it made sense even for us to continue going forward, being that Hipster was willing to split some of the cost, but they wanted to use it beyond this venture. So if we're paying for it, but it only has a one-time use to us, it might not make sense, or something along those lines. And if the time, and if we can even get it produced and created before they launch.
Right. So you were. So yours is which one here?
Third in. Up one more over. Sorry, left.
Okay, let's see.
First.
All right, so, dear colleague, Okay. You had a short. I guess your teammates, your co-counsel were not involved because you personally had a short 30 minute meeting. Were you just going to claim all the credit for this?
Absolutely.
Okay. Do you really think that you needed to define ACWS for your own client?
I would hope that.
But you did.
I did.
Why did you? Yeah, this is thought process. Just because it's probably why we did this is not only to think of it, right, but it also to actually draft a letter that you would send to your client, whether in-house or otherwise. So what you did here was a narrative, and you pointed out here the open business issue, and a recommendation that they get that your business counterparts get a proposal for Hipster, review the costs, what percentage of the cost you would be willing to cover, if any. And this is a useful observation. Hipster is looking to use this programming in the future, and it may only be useful to you for this specific venture. As in-house counsel, tone-wise, wording-wise, that would probably be us, right? But, okay. Good. So, more of a summary with open issues. You did not choose to evaluate the likelihood of the deal.
Right.
Okay. Good, Casey. Anybody else want to volunteer?
I just basically, we didn't get far, so I basically just communicated what we
here's here.
To, what we didn't agree to.
Is this yours?
Yes.
Okay.
And then I just tried to explain, how far we did get, and in our, next negotiation, my recommendations as to what I would recommend.
Okay. So it's interesting because you've actually taken the time to explain the law stuff.
Yes, a little bit.
Which I think can very much make sense in certain contexts. So we have an issue of the assignment. Good. Perhaps a little bit wordy. Okay, so we have the intellectual property issue. So you did not. So here we have the refusal. Aha! So the $10 million was proposed. So you took a.
I still think we didn't propose.
He read it off of our marked up.
But you're claiming it here.
I mean, the video said it. I really denied the video.
Good. So why do you think, coming from the same negotiation, you came out with a different tone? What was your thinking about the tone?
That I don't want to scare the client, saying, oh my God, this is, potential for disaster, but just assure them that this is what we've done. Don't promise them anything, but inform them, let them know that there's another meeting and my suggestions for the next meeting.
Okay. See all the choices you actually have to make? It's hard enough. And I think that all of them that we've discussed, and really all the ones that I've gotten so far, which is pretty much most, I think really well reflect the kinds of decisions that we as lawyers have to make. Communication is everything. Negotiations, well, drafting is one form of communication. Markups, another. Because you've got to communicate your intentions clearly. You've got to choose which things you want to mark up and think about how your choices will be received. And then, as you saw, negotiation is a lot of things, and it's a lot of things at once. And it, especially when it's not what you thought it was going to be. If the discussion's not going where you thought, because opposing counsel has too high a view of his client's own importance in the world and to your world, because you're talking about business issues when you thought you were going to talk about Section 1.3. And you've got to react, especially if you are not alone. One of the challenges I think you probably all found of being co-counsel, when things are happening so quickly, is how do you communicate with your colleagues? How do you make that decision? How do you respond? Which of you responds? Because once one of you says something, if someone else steps in and contradicts it, there went your credibility. So that is a really important lesson in communication. And then we have this. Speaking to clients. Not prospective clients. That's an entirely different talk. But these are your clients. And you're really balancing a lot of different issues here. And I think we see them in the choices that you made and the challenges you faced in making those choices. The first thing is making sure that your role is seen as a positive one. I think, Sean, your take on that definitely has some validity. I've probably shared with you my own take on this, is that lawyers are often seen as the impediments to doing business, that we get in the way. We stumbling blocks, we whichever metaphor for slowing things down and making them harder you'd like to use, believe me, it has been said about business lawyers, transactional lawyers. Because the salespeople are gung-ho, and the marketing people are gung-ho, and the product people are gung-ho, and the lawyers are oh no. No, we are not. We shouldn't, we mustn't, we better not, they better. It's not, that's a problem. And it's a problem being seen that way because we want to be heard. We want to be part of the process. We want our concerns to be taken seriously. And you know what happens if you say no too often? They stop asking us. They don't turn to us, especially, you know, they just, or they don't listen to us. Well, you said that, but it's not going to happen. We're not facing $10 million in risk, so we're not going to worry about it. It's all going to be fine. I don't need a prenup. Just because I have $20 million and she's living in a shack or he's living in a shack, I don't need a prenup. We're in love. Love. Yeah. Love.
It seems like it's also a fine line for, like, in this situation, for us to tell a person who's making a business decision, it might be up to them to decide that this business decision outweighs the liability that, you know, I could potentially take on. I think it's the counsel's job to say, here's what the liability is. Now, this is what I recommend, but it's going to be up to you to make the decision if it's worth the company and worth it a little bit of exposure.
And to a large extent, I agree, and that's really where I think I would differ from your perspective. Not to say that you were wrong in pointing out some of the risks. Your experience as someone who's been in business, who has seen deals go badly, your gut is important. And the more you do, the more trustworthy it becomes. And while, yes, our primary responsibility is to explain risks, give our best estimate as to their likelihood, right? The cost is the likelihood times the size of the exposure. It's a really small risk, but a huge possible exposure. You want to think about that. But I don't think it does our clients a service to take our own business knowledge completely out of the equation. I don't think you were suggesting that.
Correct.
But the more we can, in the context of risk assessment, convey how it impacts on the actual business, not in the abstract, but in the, okay, here's what our real risks are because we know as lawyers about our business, I think that is what makes this a most effective approach. And you do have to balance, how much are we going to be lawyerly about this? It's going to partly depend on your client. Is your client well versed in contracts and assignments and warranties and indemnification, and those words are meaningful, and the client will understand why you just spent all this time arguing about it, and the fact that you didn't get what you want matters, or not? Is your client someone who is, we're going to do this, everything's going to be fine, you know, I don't want to hear about risks? Well, if that's your client, you know, to go into, well, there's an indemnification provision, and, you know, that's probably not going to penetrate. So as you did this, all of you had in mind some client, some level of sophistication, whether not very sophisticated, but apparently very interested in it. Or not sophisticated, or just really focusing on the business. So we do, there is that balance. We have to keep to our roles. And I should say, parenthetically, there's one really important, bless you, reason why, if our job is solely lawyerly, that is, we're not director of business development, but simply director of legal affairs or in-house counsel, why is it that we want to stick to just the lawyerly stuff? What, setting aside this thing, anybody know why it is that when you are the lawyer, especially an in-house lawyer, it's really important to keep your legal advice separate from anything else you're communicating? Yes, but that's sort of the work product, meaning what?
That there are certain things that are not, like you have to pass your file on, or you don't have to pass your document.
When does the issue of work product versus non-work product come up? No, that's not really what I was thinking about. Because anything that's in your file is in your file, whatever. Sean?
It's evidentiary.
So, and therefore?
Certain documents you don't have to admit that means because it's work product.
So, and therefore?
You don't have to disclose it.
Why? Because it's privileged. Do not lose sight of the attorney-client privilege. When one is an outside lawyer, the boundaries are pretty clear. You're the attorney. There's a client. Privileged. Most of the time. And I actually want to, it's not really relevant to this, but saw an article today about another case where, because the client was writing from a work email account and then got into a lawsuit with the employer, the court found that the letter from the client to the lawyer about the case was not protected by the attorney-client privilege. There was also, by the way, another, that's a challenge, but more relevantly to this class, I should say, I saw an article last week about, I believe, no, I'm sorry, it is relevant in the following way. There was a tax dispute. And the defense of the alleged non-payer was that it had reasonably relied on legal advice. It had been responsible, it had gotten advice, the advice turned out to be something with which the IRS disagreed. But the defense was the legal advice. So, in the trial, the hearing, the commission said, okay, show us the legal advice. And the party said, no, attorney-client privilege, legal communication. You know what the court said? Nope. If the defense is the substance of that legal advice, once you've done that, you have waived your privilege. If your defense is, I relied on my lawyer's statements, that's the defense. You've waived your client. Remember, the client gets to waive or not waive the privilege. The client has waived the privilege. So it's relevant here because there may be opinions about patentability or non-infringement, right? My lawyer said we didn't infringe. Or I went ahead with this because I had an opinion of non-infringement. Let's see it. No, it's from my lawyer. If that other case's precedent continues, your clients may have to disclose your communications to them. So privilege is not absolute, but we can do things as lawyers that weaken it as well. Our clients could write us from work. Our clients can, you know, and of course the lawyer who said, why don't you use this as a defense? That could be an interesting conversation after that didn't work. But for outside lawyers, you're a lawyer. You're sent, you know, it's attorney work product. It's pretty clear. In-house counsel, though, not nearly as clear. And that's where these kinds of things, if you're an in-house lawyer, beyond the issue of how much do I tell my client. The client, of course, you're not telling the client. Because who's the client? It's true for outside counsel as well, but who's the client when you're in-house? It's the business, the corporation. Everybody works for the client, but you don't report to the certificate of incorporation, right? You don't walk into the certificate's office and talk to it. No, you're talking to the CFO or the CEO or whomever, the senior vice president. Thank you very much. But so that's for the purposes of privilege issues, you're communicating to a representative of the client as a representative of the client. But you still are potentially protected by the attorney-client privilege. And when I say you're protected, I mean that very personally. Yes, the issue is your client, and it's the requirement that your client has to have things admitted. But let me tell you, if I haven't mentioned this before, and I know we're going to talk about bankruptcy, I guess, on Thursday, and that's where this all came up. Not personal bankruptcy, mind you, but my client. Let me tell you that when everybody else of senior management level is getting subpoenaed, called to testify by, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the Attorney General's Office, because there are some allegations which turned out to not be true, but still, it is a wonderful, wonderful thing to know that you, as the lawyer, having given just legal advice, unless, of course, you're you know, the CEO decides to waive the privilege, you don't have to testify. You don't have to be deposed. This is a good thing. It's a good thing. And so the last thing we want to do as lawyers is enhance the risk, right? Raise our own chances of getting called or deposed or convicted. So first things first, do not advocate for or participate in illegal activity. And if you have any questions, you can talk to the lawyers for MCI WorldCom or Enron. They have visiting hours every other week. You'll have to talk through a thing of glass on a phone, but you know, right? It's lawyers, being the lawyer doesn't make you immune for prosecution if you're involved in the criminal activity. But beyond that, letters to a client, conversations with the person to whom you report. You have, if you're being lawyerly, you're doing the lawyer thing, do the lawyer thing only. If you're giving legal advice, do it without, you know, if it's in the letter, oh, by the way, I wanted to talk to you about the sales numbers as well, separate letter. Separate conversations, separate meetings. The more you can keep the lawyer stuff separate from anything else you're interested in or working on or responsible for, the more likely it is that should there ever be some sort of legal process, your piece of this will remain protected by the attorney-client privilege. So what do you do about business advice? Given all of that, given that reality, what do you do? How far can you go? How far should you go? No surprise. I'm a firm believer that we should be giving business-informed advice. But the thrust of what we do has to be risk part of it. The risk part is what we do. And so what do you do in this situation where you've only gone a half an hour's worth and then your opposing lawyer had to go off to do something else and you didn't get very far? And maybe you have a sense that, you know, maybe it didn't go well. So let's start with that. What if it didn't go well? What if the negotiation went really badly? You got nothing. And you should have gotten something, and this wasn't one of those, thank you, sir, may I have another situations. You had enough bargaining power in theory, and you were making reasonable enough arguments that you should have gotten somewhere, and you didn't. So the first thing you have to think about is why. What was going on? Was the lawyer getting harsh words? Was the lawyer just an asshole? Pardon the expression. A bulldog, let's put it that way. Someone nasty for the sake of nasty and probably not doing his client or her client any favors. Hard to judge sometimes. You know. Was the lawyer simply sticking on things and hoping that you wouldn't fight back, that you'd be intimidated? And then how do you communicate that to your CEO? It's not easy. So you do have to provide some kind of interpretation. Now, whether you want to do as Sean did and suggest that if you can't get a warranty or indemnity, you remove ourselves from a potentially damaging situation, that might be going a little far.
That's why I wanted to set up a meeting with the president.
Fair enough, but this is where you started. Again, I understand your decision-making process. You did think it through, but I'll tell you why I think that this Because what you focused on is the lawyer stuff. A warranty only matters if there's a lawsuit. Indemnification only matters if there's a lawsuit, which you're not going to be able to convince your happy-go-lucky CEO is ever going to happen. This deal is going to be well. It's going to go great. That's where they are, right? Get the prenup. I don't want to hear it. You're just being a lawyer again. You're talking about warranties and indemnities. This game's going to be phenomenal. Look at the reviews. Who are you, lawyer, telling me because you couldn't successfully negotiate some piece of language that I have no idea, even though your co-counsel really tried to explain it, I have no idea what this means. This is not the deal. This is lawyer stuff. Don't bother me with lawyer stuff. That's your job. Yes. So that's why I think that if your instincts are, especially if you have a good relationship with your colleague, the CEO or the CFO, and your instincts, based on your experience, are there's something funky here. That might not be appropriate to a letter. That might be a conversation. But you shouldn't hesitate, assuming that you just don't happen to be paranoid. You shouldn't hesitate to convey your sense of where it goes. Going on here? You've now seen a side that your colleagues have not. They're seeing the salespeople. You're seeing the risk manager. But you want to be successful. And setting aside the it didn't happen, I need to blame somebody else perspective, that may be true. Again, I understand where you were coming from. But if you want to convince someone, a business person especially, that there's something going on, and you were being reasonable and they were being unreasonable, you really have to put it, you have to set it up in terms of things that matter. You know, we started talking about the delivery dates, and they didn't commit to any. That's got some concern, and maybe it's appropriate at this point, although I'm not sure it really came up, for me to share with you the additional facts for Hipsters Council that I had and that Paul Rebell had, right? Okay. Short window for testing, any delays could push off the launch. On the other hand, the limited beta testing means that the game's servers have never been close to full simultaneous utilization. That's spelled right. And bugs remain to be identified and fixed. Your developers are expressing some internal doubt about the launch date, and you expect there could be substantial service and customer support challenges once the game goes live. I don't think any of you expressed any doubt as to the launch date. Some of you were a little concerned about the quality of the product and wanting to test it. But this is software. And so what could have happened and then would have, you know, perhaps been an appropriate thing to add to a client letter was if you want to think about the ways that they can screw up. And so rather than perhaps, and again, not meant as criticism of any of you in the half an hour you had, but just going forward, think about the type of business the other side is, where its potential problems are likely to be. And those are the ones you really want to push hard on. If it's something that's complicated, that has a lot of pieces that have to come together physically or digitally or structurally. Focus on delivery date. Focus on launch date. See how likely, how comfortable the opposing counsel is in sticking, in committing to a launch date with consequences for missing it. Is it, you know, is it a material breach if the game doesn't go live? And you have to want to be very careful how you define live on July 1st. You know, I could be talking about this in the abstract, but does anyone here remember what happened when the Affordable Care Act website went live? There was a well-publicized example of exactly this. If you follow video games, you saw it when The Sims on live. Let's wonder if we can find that. Less well-publicized, but let's see. When The Sims Online went live, there were some serious problems. Come on. Kick. There we go. So it was SimCity, right? Forbes. SimCity launch marred by No, I don't want to hear about what George Bancroft has to say. I hate that Forbes' website does that. So let's see. This was a business publication. SimCity launch marred by server problems. Last night, this was about a year ago, 13 months ago, EA and Maxis launched SimCity, the highly anticipated remake of the classic city building sim. As with Diablo 3 before, the developers made the controversial decision to require a constant internet connection, even for single player modes. And as was also true with Diablo 3, the servers didn't prove up to the task to handling the launch traffic. Players were reporting long delays for both the original download and the server space required to play. This was a huge, huge problem. And when you're dealing with a company that depends on servers and is expecting a large number of people, this is a real potential pitfall. Ask all the people who tried to sign up for health insurance on October 1st or whatever it was when allegedly healthcare.gov, right? Anybody doing the, any of you doing the exchanges? Were you? So you were hoping to participate, and you went online, and what happened? You were unable to access it. And you were, of course, not alone. Now imagine you are a business depending on that to work. I don't know, you could sort of, you're a new clinic, or you're a new health insurance company, right, and you're relying on that thing to send you customers. And you've hired lots of people who are sitting at their desks. And you've put out coffee and all the things that you do. And nothing happens. Because there's this bottleneck out there. So as a lawyer, even if you're not a technologist, or a whateverist, knowing a lot about the business on the other side. You need to know enough about it, because remember, the salespeople are not thinking about what's going to go wrong. You are the risk management professional. And so you need to push hard on those things that are the biggest risks to the success from the other side. So Is it intellectual property protection? Well, let's think that through. Because this is what your client is going to say to you when you send a letter focusing on IP. How often is it that an advertiser or a marketing partner is looking at experiences a lawsuit because its partner has an IP issue? Yeah, it's a risk. Is it a frequent risk? You're not the licensee in the sense of, you know, some of you were. Those of you who were co-branding with the VGG, right? That made more sense. Yes, that was a real issue because you were putting your name like EA, right? EA did not develop The Sims, or maybe it did. But a lot of these EA online games, somebody else develops and Electronic Arts co-brands and distributes. And for them, yeah. But that's the secondary issue. The intellectual property rights, it's important. But a lot of that has to do with the sophistication of the other partner. The bigger issue is the thing going to work? And the salespeople on the other side are going to be saying, oh, of course it's going to work. But the lawyers won't. Not in writing. Not if they're any good. So if you say to the lawyer, okay, it's going to launch on July 1st? Yes. And on July 1st, you know, as many customers as want to are going to be able to get it because we're going to be pushing this thing out to our retail partners, soda drinkers, book readers, whatever. Didn't mean to slight other retail partners. So, right? We're putting our reputation on the line here, guys. So you're going to commit to July 1st being a full production launch capable of simultaneously using this many people. Yes? Let's put it in the contract. Oh. You're not putting that in the contract? That's a risk issue. That's when you say, dear CEO, just to let you know, one of the things that we highlighted was, you know, we requested that Hipster commit to a full, you know, commit that it will launch on time, fully functional. And CEO, I know you don't know anything about video games. Remember that healthcare.gov debacle? That's what we're worried about. This is the same thing. It's got servers. And they have to be working. And so we put into the contract, we proposed that they either do that or penalty, termination, whatever. And they were unwilling. Now, it doesn't mean they won't make it, but that suggests that they may have issues. And we want to consider what happens if they miss that deadline. Or maybe we want to put off our marketing pitch or what our piece of it until we set that milestone. Or we want to find out how they're testing for full capacity or whatever. When Paul said at the end of his night that you should always make sure to prioritize what you're going to ask for because you never know how much time you're going to have and put it first, part of that is, what do I need? And in a situation like this, the most important things that you're going to bring to the table and then convey to your client are the what-ifs. And the what-ifs have to be from most likely to happen to least likely. We as lawyers, we get very, very invested in warranties and representations, in indemnification provisions, in assignment provisions, change of control provisions, force majeure provisions, miscellaneous provisions, because that's that's the stuff we do. That those are our magic words. We understand them, at least more than most other people understand them. But that's, those are things, those are the what ifs that are a little further down. What if there's a lawsuit? Well, we want to make sure that we don't have to travel to bring a lawsuit if we need to. So we'll deal with the venue, the where the suit is brought. Okay. What if they sell their company? Well, you know, we want to make sure we're not dealing with a competitor or someone who's going to, because there's a certain amount of risk we have and we're providing confidential information. So let's figure out something there. But what if they just don't work? What if it doesn't work? What if it kills people? Well, you know, if it's software, it's not as likely to kill people. But if you're co-branding with a parachute company, or, you know, you are Eddie Bauer and you're negotiating with Ford over the co-branding of the Ford Explorer, which was a real thing, the Eddie Bauer Ford Explorer. Now imagine if those Eddie Bauer Ford Explorers were running on Firestone tires. Whoosh, you know, it's just not good. What's out of your client's control that can come back real world tomorrow to bite your client? When I was negotiating against the Soda and Co. people, one of the things I had in mind was this is a food product. Food products can kill people. You know, food products can be contaminated. Do I want my brand, the fact that Hanna-Barbera was willing to put its brand on Flintstone vitamins, I think was an artifact of the early 1970s when it began. I would imagine that if someone came to major corporation today and said, we would like to put your brand on a product that is designed for children to only take one of, but tastes good enough that they might be willing. Oh, and by the way, if they take too many of them, you've got to call poison control. Can we put Fred and Barney on that, please? I don't think you'd get a yes today. Anybody disagree? Would you advise your media client to put its name on children's vitamins? I wouldn't. You know, you have to think about what they could do or what could happen to what they do. So if you're dealing with a food company, there are food risks. If you're dealing with a online video game which relies on servers, or an online anything that relies on servers, that's where the risk is. It's not just a lawyer risk. It is, because you want to write into the contract the what if and figure out the consequences. But then you go back to your client, who wakes up, and you say, you know, client, we were thinking through the what-ifs, because that's what you pay us for. Or CEO, that's what you hired us to do on behalf of our mutual employer. And we were thinking that the what-if is the servers don't work. And we asked that question, and we didn't get a good response. Or, you know, CEO, that as we discussed, Hipster itself is a new company, but it's owned by Fogey Corp, and Fogey has lots of money. So, you know, we were thinking, you were thinking, worst comes to the worst, if we do need to sue them or go get after them for money, there's Fogey Corp. No problem. But we asked about that, CEO, and we asked if Fogey could sign the contract and be liable, jointly liable, or Fogey could be part of the indemnity, they said no. They said that the only entity that was going to sign the contract, be on the hook for it, is this brand new, we have no idea how well it's capitalized, LLC that they spun off, but it's wholly owned. So there's no public financial records. We have no idea. So one of the things we proposed, since they weren't willing to have it, was we asked them to get a big insurance policy and name us as an additional insured, so that even if Hipster itself doesn't have a lot of money, the insurance company does. And they didn't go with that either. And that's where you say, we are concerned, based on the response we got in our negotiations to essentially lawyer issues, that they are not as well positioned as we'd hoped. But do you say, don't do the deal? Well, if that's your responsibility, if you've been asked that question, sure. But you don't have to say it. That's when you get into the what-ifs. That's when you get into the, okay, here's the risks. So you say, given this, here's what we see as possible. If they don't launch on time, this amount of investment's not going to work. Or if we're co-branded and they have a healthcare.gov or EA or Sims Online level of scandal, right? So here we have EA and Maxis. Right, here it is. EA and Maxis. Now, as far, any video gamers here, is Maxis the company that developed this and EA is the distributor? Whatever. Let's assume that's the case. Right? Or Origin, whatever Origin is. So Origin, I guess, is the developer. Origin. So I guess Origin is the developer. I'm not sure who Maxis is. But whatever. But here's EA saying, them, but EA is in every article. So if your client, right, is jointly branding, you know, VGG thought it scored a great coup with Hipster's new game, Reflection, but VGG is looking less than smart now that Reflection is a cracked mirror. You know, people are seeing themselves in the blank screens that should be the Reflection game. Doesn't look good. So that's your risk. Or, you know, we're putting our brand on the soda and understand that they are going out there and we haven't tested it. We have no idea what the ingredients are going to be. We have no control. And so if they put in some coloring that causes people to turn purple and have spots, it's going to be our brand on it. Remember our Disney health daycare centers. Why was it that Walt Disney objected? Because if kids had died, there would have been Mickey, you know? House of Mouse kills kids. Not good. And whether or not they handled it well, that's clearly got to be some of the concern. So when you communicate with your client, particularly after a challenging negotiation, you got to say, okay, here's what we asked for. Here's why. Here's the response we got. And here's what could go wrong. And then, you business person, you make the call. And if you want us to go forward, here's what we can do to help manage those risks. And then you have to think about tone. Do you do it as a formal letter? It depends. Who's your audience? If your audience is either your colleague in the next office, you might want to be less formal. On the other hand, if you're concerned that someday there's going to be a shareholder suit, and they're going to be looking at the business decisions that were made, and maybe there will be an opportunity because they're shareholders. I don't know if there's privilege there because shareholders own the company. So you may want to make sure that just the old memo to file, right? Why do we write a memo to file? That's a cover your ass memo. I asked the question. So you might want to be more formal than you otherwise would in your conversation with Bob or Helen or whomever. But if it's particularly if it's an in-house to in-house, you probably don't want to use words like heretofore and herewith. That's, again, this was all in the abstract. These were all hypotheticals. But audience and purpose is a key part of writing as well. So, I know I've been rambling, but I'm trying to do as much of a brain dump as I can. This is not an easy process. You'd almost think this is the easy part. Negotiation is hard. Drafting is not easy. I'll tell you where it's really hard. What I think is the most strenuous, and maybe some of you have experienced this, a conference call negotiation. Those can go on forever, and you have so few clues as to what's going on. Very, very exhausting. Oh, lawyer tip. Assuming that in your practice people still use phones of some sort, here is a lawyer tip for you. Get your employer or firm to invest in, or if you have to, buy for yourself a headset. You will see if you come and visit the Fortress of Geekitude next door. You see my office, I have a headset, which I've had it ever since I first started practicing, and someone else in the office had one, and I saw him or her, I don't remember who it was, use it. That was it. Because speakerphones are annoying, and this, or this, or this, is painful after 3 hours. With a headset, you can have your notes, you can be heard, you can hear. It sounds stupid, but it's true. Headsets, very important. Good monitors, 2 monitors if you can pick it up, very important. If you touch type, ergonomic keyboard. I always buy my own because I started getting pains in my hands. Don't forget, in everything else that you have to worry about, that part of what's going to make you effective, whatever choices you make in your tone and your style and your whatever, don't forget your work environment. Make it so that you can be the most effective person you are. You can be. Again, not all that relevant here, but I want to make sure it gets said. But absolutely, when you're negotiating, especially on the phone, headsets, very important. Those of you who haven't completed this because you didn't get it in time or because I still have to put up the video because I doubled one of them, please get it in as soon as you can. Wednesday here, normal time, yes? Thursday, and the last two classes, we're back to actual theory. Bankruptcy and antitrust. I think it's antitrust and then bankruptcy. So there is actually some reading, which I'd like you to at least skim so we have some vocabulary to share. For Wednesday, Thursday will be online, likely through Adobe Connect. I will send out through TWIN. You're all now getting the TWIN, I hope, successfully. I will send out the instructions. It will be recorded, but I hope all of you, A, can participate, and B, please, if you have a webcam, and especially if you have a microphone, please turn it on. I feel very lonely being the only voice in the wilderness. Questions? Have a good night.